right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? How is everything all right? How's you and yours? How are you and theirs? How is you and what is happening? Man, this state is underwater. Down here in Southern California, a lot of rain. I didn't see, my house is still here. There's been some menacing water in the streets, some rivers and streams where there once were roads are still roads, but a lot of water. My heart goes out to anybody that's in massive, disastrous flooding situations or had accidents or, you know, what the bad stuff. But down here, it's just a lot of fucking water. Anyways, in my house, I don't know about down my block. Maybe I'm being totally selfish. And I got to be honest with you. I'm grateful for the water. It's not natural water. Nothing seems natural anymore. It's just dumping out of the sky. Maybe I'm projecting, but it just seems that any weather event, if it is an actual event, is somehow extreme. And this has just been a lot of water. Outside of panic and sort of kind of going into a mild depression because of the grayness and the wetness, I'm happy. I'm always happy when it rains in Los Angeles. I'm thrilled, actually. And I have to hold on to that so I don't drift into a rain-based depression. Though it has wet up. It has wet up, and maybe there'll be more. I do know I'm going to have to get new rain gutters. I'm probably going to have to get a new roof. But this is the beauty of home ownership, right? Yes. Yes, folks. So look, you guys, today I'm going to talk to my co-star from Two Leslie, the amazing Andrea Riceborough. You might also know her from things like Birdman or The Death of Stalin or her Black Mirror episode. She's a astounding actress, a brilliant actor, actress. Can't you just call everybody an actor now? How does it work? She's amazing. And I talked to her. I don't know when I got into Two Leslie that I understood not the impact of the movie, but what I was really getting into. And it's probably better off. I didn't really think about it that much other than should I do the movie or should I not do the movie in the middle of peak COVID. And I was also kind of still pretty devastated with a sense of grief and darkness. And there wasn't much going on in the world, but I was really resistant to doing the movie because it just seemed like a hassle. This is the weird thing about me, I guess, and acting is that I didn't set out in my life to, I don't make acting my primary focus because I don't think I could hack it. And I never thought I was good enough and I never had representation. I'm not even sure I had an agent for about 25 years. I think I had people do my manager favors, my manager at the time, but I don't think I really had anyone representing me. And I went on like 4 auditions in 20 years. But getting into to Leslie, I mean, I knew Andrea was a great actress, but I don't know. I don't know if I put things in the proper perspective. It's getting a lot of attention right now. It's getting a little bit of a push from a lot of fellow actors for her to get on the docket for an Academy Award nomination, which she certainly deserves. And, you know, I don't think when I got into the movie that I realized just what it would become. Obviously, you never know, but I'm not even sure I realized just how amazing and well thought of she was. You know, I was out of my mind, and all I knew was, you know, I get this call from this director, and he wants me to do the movie, and I'm like, I don't know, man. And then he enlists Chelsea Handler to start pestering me, and there was really no reason why I shouldn't do it. It was only 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or, you know, my shoot was like, I don't know, 12 days, I don't know. But it's the middle of COVID. I think I'm still in some sort of PTSD around it. Like, I barely remember doing it. You know, I just remember that I was nervous about the accent and I thought to myself, if I'm going to do acting, I should take some chances. So I did it. I did an accent. I did this Texan type of accent and I showed up emotionally and I was present and I listened. But the odd thing I think about, you know, if I'm going to be honest about whatever acting I was doing, I knew that my character, despite whatever backstory I put in place for the character or what was going on in the movie, I knew that my character, both on screen and off, was there to support Andrea and her character. An almost immediate natural codependency was established. I don't even know why it happened exactly. And it was perfect for the part. And it was also, you know, part of myself that I don't even, that I don't really cop to all the time. I just know that when I got on set and we started doing scenes, that my character is fundamentally a codependent guy that wants to help this woman who's, you know, tragically submerged in alcoholism and wants to help her. Now, obviously, this guy is not naive, but yet he still looks past a disastrous situation to help this woman. And I just felt that right away. I felt it for Andrea. I felt in a sense that my job as an actor was to support this woman in this work. And I knew that right away. I wasn't told that, but it also fit perfectly well with the characters at hand. Like, I was concerned about her, but look, she was totally into her trip, but I just, like, whether she completely knew it or not, and I think it she did in the scenes, yeah, I was completely concerned and deferring and totally kind of codependent with Andrea and with Andrea's character and my character. So I guess what I'm saying when I think about the acting is that, I mean, I don't know if I would have been that way naturally, and I don't know if it was because the character was naturally that way, but I did find it in myself to show up for her as a character and as a person. It just, it all kind of mixed together. I don't know, man. I think I did all right. People seem to think I did all right. People love the movie and they think she's astounding in it, which she is. But I think that my friend Brill put it correctly. He texted me. He's like, you know, I went and saw Two Leslie, and the first third of the movie is just all Andrea. And he was like, you know, dude, that performance was beyond comprehension. It was so fucking good. And I was concerned. I was worried for you as the movie went on and you hadn't arrived yet or you hadn't appeared yet. My friend Steve was concerned. He was concerned that, how is Mark gonna fit into this amazing, masterful performance? And he was surprised. He was complimentary, and he said it must have been like being in the ring with Tyson. Now, I didn't really feel that. You know, I don't really know what I felt. I just know that when I'm in the movies, that I am pretty present in the scenes. So I wasn't thinking about how great she was doing. I was just thinking about, how do I help her? Not as an actor, but also as a character. And, you know, what is my line? You know, what are my boundaries in this relationship? And these weren't really things that were happening to me. There were things that were happening to the person I was playing. And I didn't even know how that was happening. I didn't know how it was transpiring. I can't even explain it. But I did know that in my personal life, I was, you know, in grief and also tired of isolation. And we're on set and everyone's wearing a mask in between shots. The only people that can't wear masks are the actors while they're shooting. There was no real hanging out. Craft services wasn't even fun. The trailer wasn't fun. You know, in between, you know, scenes were just masked up and visored up, and it was all pretty uncomfortable. But there was something about that that lent a sort of urgency to the scene at hand. It was almost like we were the only ones who had the freedom to engage like regular people used to engage. In the movie, you know, during the shooting, you know, when they said action, whatever's going on with me and the other actors, we were the only people that were enabled to live regular lives for one take at a time. So maybe there was something about that, about the excitement of that, or about the shock of that, or the nature of that, that we were actually almost doing something forbidden by engaging without masks intimately and close to each other in each of these scenes. Maybe there was something that just electrified that movie, partially because we were doing something radical at that time just by engaging like regular people in a movie. It was just a hell of an experience that I barely remember. just because that entire period of COVID and for a year or so after Lynn died, it just feels so almost hallucinatory, almost like an illusion. Just like, I don't know if it's from PTSD or just, again, I've been talking about this. My nature is to just engage with the present pretty heavily. And then when I walk away from it, unless it makes a profound impact, I don't remember it as anything other than an engagement. But I do remember there were definitely moments where I'm working with Andrea on this movie, To Leslie, that were pretty great. And pretty, you know, when you do a scene, like there's a scene where I talk to her at the picnic table, and you realize when they say cut that you've landed in something, that something happened there in that special space of a scene being shot, and it just felt true. And they say cut, and you're like, wow, okay, man, I was in it. She was in it. But it was a real honor to work with her. And I'm glad that so many people are coming around to the movie. But she's pretty humble, and she's the real deal. And you can kind of listen for yourself when I talk to her now. And To Leslie, I forgot to mention this, is now available to buy or rent on most video on demand platforms like Apple TV and Prime Video. Intimidating. It was more intimidating to have this conversation with her than it was to act with her for some reason. Acting was a lot easier. This is me and Andrea Riceboro. It's so weird with acting, though. There's so much there's so much out of your control.
Everything.
And you can do, yeah, and you can do whatever you do, and you still don't know what. You can walk away from feeling like I did great, and then it's like garbage. And you don't know why or how, or you do. Maybe.
Yes, no, and I've said this a million times, but every single time I think that I'm doing something very well, I know it's my worst ever work.
Really?
Because why the fuck am I thinking about that? You know what I mean?
But even after?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I can't watch half the shit that I do. I can't. Do you watch everything you do?
For the last 12 years I've been producing things. So for that time, out of necessity, I have had to watch myself, and sometimes I've been in it and producing it at the same time.
Right.
When that happens, of course, yes, I watch it, you know.
Yeah.
And you go through the whole process in post, and then to a distribution level, and you get, you become so familiar with that performance in a really strange way, because you're both producing it and the sort of physical meat vehicle that the character's sitting on, and you see it's sort of an out of body experience.
You
after
have to
a while.
Detach yourself somehow, or it just happens naturally.
But if I'm not producing it, absolutely not.
Really?
You know, I don't. I mean, I suppose back to going from the inside out. But you know, when you're a child and you look at a baby and they look through these. Their eyes are like portals into the world, and they look with no self-consciousness, and they can stare at you for 6 or 7 hours, you know, and they have nobody's grabbed a fig leaf, you know. There's just a complete lack of self-consciousness, that observation, that being totally present. And in a sense, as divorced from that as we get, we spend the rest of our lives trying to get back to it, I think, in a way, you know, in adulthood.
At least for a moment. You can't really enter the world naked and confused.
but desperately trying to just have an unself-conscious experience, whatever it is,
That's right.
And so much of adulthood, so many of the lessons in adulthood are about that, about just really being connected to yourself again, you know, in some way.
Yeah.
Trying to get connected to something.
Right.
Whether it's yourself or something else.
Right.
And when I don't know about you, but when I watch myself, I really develop quite a strong, objective opinion or perspective about what's going on.
Yeah.
Not even me particularly, the character or, you know.
But do you ever have that moment where you're like, I could have done that differently.
I think only if I'm not lost in it.
Oh, so you make no mistakes if you're lost in it. But if you see yourself come out of it, even if you were the only one who knows for a moment in something that makes
yes, then
the
we
film.
Then we'd have to do it again. But I always know that from the inside anyway. So, you know,
you
I don't need to watch.
You mean on you make that choice. But you don't, you've never had that experience like when you're watching something that's already done, that's already in the can?
Well, a strange thing is,
yeah,
I've never played anything with my own voice or my own, yeah, you know, with my own physicality or whatever.
Ever?
No.
Hmm.
I dabbled in it recently, which was a horrible experience.
Really? Really? Oh. Huh. Well, that's kind of interesting. And, I mean, what was the dabbling? What happened?
Well, all of which is to say, I think that because of that, I'm afforded a little bit of distance,
right,
if
okay,
you know what I mean.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
So there is a...
And you know that.
I can be taken away a bit by the story if I do have to watch myself.
Right.
Imagining okay. that perhaps I'm somebody else.
So what was this thing that you experimented with being you in?
I produced something recently with... Fremantle that had been in development for quite a long time, and
is it with your production company?
It wasn't. I independently
okay.
was part of producing it. We make film. My production company makes films, but this was a sort of episodic mini series.
Uh-huh.
I'm less familiar. I'm much more familiar with film and theatre, yeah. and I feel much more comfortable there. But so
what makes it different, a mini series? Just because you keep doing it? I mean.
I mean, it's such a large question, but it's fantastic when you have one director.
Yeah.
I think,
okay. Right. Yeah.
Or
yeah.
maybe two at a stretch.
Okay.
And there's one clear creative
vision. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't really enjoy the process of people coming in and out and the doors, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Spinning
yeah.
around.
Oh, so that was happening?
No, wasn't
okay.
happening at all.
Okay.
Wasn't happening at all. But it's kind of difficult to talk about. It's like. I think you work with people
yeah.
and you trust them. You know,
right.
you and I trusted each
other. Sure.
You and I trust each other. And I know that whatever sort of goes between us or what happens between our characters
yeah.
is it sort of remains in that world of our characters.
Yeah.
But when you are developing things sometimes with people, they want to put your story into the story because it makes it a more interesting quilt.
Or they think it's going to be more authentic. Uh-huh.
And actually, I think that ends up feeling a little...
uncomfortable.
A little bit like... a little bit intrusive, you know.
Oh,
very,
yeah.
very intrusive.
Huh.
You know, of course, you bring all of yourself
sure.
to whatever you do, don't
yeah.
you? Whether it's
yeah.
standing in front of many people and making them laugh or creating this, you know... hybrid of you and something else.
Yeah, yeah.
You're your tool.
Yeah.
Well, we are our own tool in,
right.
in all of this. You can't avoid that.
Right.
Innately, you're going to...
You're
the fabric
in.
Of it,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah,
but I think it's wonderful to have some space between who you are.
Yeah.
And what you're exploring at work, just like anybody would have in
right.
any industry.
And there oddly, you have it usually.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people think they know me, and they know me to a degree. And my comedy is very personal, and this is what I'm doing here is very personal. But there's still 23 hours a day, you know, where I'm having
mm-hmm.
a life
mm-hmm.
and I'm processing feelings and emotions that
yeah.
they're not theirs. And there are some things I keep to myself, not many, but there's a few.
those things that when you're reading Terry Pratchett on the loo, you know, like they're really. The really private moments.
Yeah, but that's not that loaded a private moment.
No, but, it's not really.
But yeah, but there's definitely, sure, there are things that you naturally, no matter how much you put all in into anything, I think you do seek on some basic level to protect yourself a little bit in terms of you, yourself.
Certainly, and also to keep developing
yeah.
as a person. It's very odd. People who've had to develop in front of the world, and so many people do now with social media. I'm not on social media, but so many people do now
yeah.
with social media. They have their entire persona or avatar.
Oh, yeah,
that
sure.
horrible, detestable word brand
yeah.
has been in relationship with the world.
Yeah, and a lot of people are so
platform.
Right, they're so conscious of that, and that's a choice they're making.
Mm.
You know, I guess I'm on the other side of the arc of sort of like, how do I pull out You know, like I think I'm about done.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got involved with that stuff, but I was never really conscious of a brand or whatever, but I am conscious of oversharing and of putting a lot of stuff out there. But I think that it's its own thing and that a lot of those people, if they're huge or they're famous already or they have a career, I'm not sure where that comes from. I imagine it's not totally their own choice, but they're being told to do that to stay, you know, in the mix or relevant. You know, but some people who are, that is how they're starting their career.
I think it's very deceptive, that idea of, well, the concept of remaining relevant in this very, you know, on the length of the universe, the shavings of a fingernail.
Sure.
In time.
Whatever that means.
Well. It's, everything's so transient. And
yes.
You know, relevance, what is 10 minutes these days?
But philosophically, that takes some sort of, you know, existential maturity to really kind of frame it in that, like, you know, look, we're none of us are really that important.
It does, but we have so many examples, don't we? We have so many examples of, I mean,
of course.
Even when the Egyptians, you know, and you spend time in Egypt and you think,
yeah,
there's one or two of these people who've come through and they're a literal gargantuan monuments to their.
Yeah.
Spirit.
Yeah.
It's what happened there was meaningful.
Right. Right.
What happened there is meaningful, and that does have value. That has undeniable value.
Sure. And it's also, it has, you know, it's a geographical reality. It's a structure. Mm-hmm. Whereas like social media, it's just a burning heap of nothing that just disappears.
Do you know what
day.
I watched the other day? It made me laugh so much. It does every single time I watch it, for your consideration.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God. It's just so...
The movie?
Yeah. It's just so fucking funny. But, you know, just the idea that on the... Just the sniff of a fart of some sort of nomination. Nobody even gets nominated, I think, in the movie. But just in the sniff of a fart, which is how I see social media.
Yeah.
Everybody loses their minds, their faces, you know, any connection to reality.
Well, that's that sort of weird, like, it's totally ego-driven, you know, where we live in this sort of weird, malignant narcissist culture. It's innate. And everybody's looking to connect somehow. But there is this weird distance there, too. It's like people live online or they live, you know, they don't even have to use their real name. Mm-hmm. They're like, it's something that happens in an emotional moment that goes out into the whole world. Mm-hmm. But I wonder how really connected anybody is to it. I mean, some people are because they're addicted to it. But ultimately...
I think we're in a lonely time.
Yeah.
I do.
A very... But a fully chaotic and highly motivated and informed lonely time.
Desperately lonely time, yeah.
Desperately and elaborately lonely.
Deeply connected and disconnected all at once.
It's true, right?
Absolutely. And for so many, for all of the good reasons that us being connected, you know, there are so many good reasons to be connected. It's so important for most people in the world to be able to be connected. And then for the ones who have connection coming out their ears and, you know, all of the advantages, it's like probably not very important at all for them to be connected. You know, I mean, it's not a question of life or death. It's not a political necessity.
Right. But what does connection mean? It's sort of interesting because, like, you know, when you act or when I act or when we acted together or when I go on stage in front of people, like my life is sort of like I don't have a work environment unless I'm doing something or unless I'm doing this. But it always involves real connection. Mm-hmm. You can't, with what we do, you can't kind of like sleep through it. Like, you know, there's, and also like in life, I guess what my brain did when we were talking about it is that like when we're in real trouble, it seems as if people can't identify that real connection in real life, or that becomes, it doesn't register the same way, or it's not enough, or it becomes boring. Mm-hmm. That, you know, this compulsive engagement with this hyper-real and all these social media platforms, that's a sort of, you know, juice, but it's more of an addictive juice. But the actual, because it's a little menacing to be with real.
Well, it's also sort of a replacement for community in a sense, isn't it?
Sure, yeah.
And everyone has a different relationship to community. Some people have no interest in it whatsoever, and that's completely fine. And some people do have are very strongly connected to some sort of community.
Yeah.
But the feeling, maybe to replace the word community with something else, just the feeling of connection and having perspective.
Yeah. Well, you must have it a bit if you're not engaging with any of that shit.
Well, I mean, to me, that feeling is hope.
Yeah.
And the opposite of it is hopelessness, if you know what I mean.
Sure. The electric hopelessness. the sort of like frenetic hopelessness.
I think so, but I think the amount that we all work now, whichever industry or walk of life you're in.
Always working.
So much of life is consumed with work.
Believe me, I think about that all the time.
It's hard to not have a very insular experience of life anyway.
Right. Where do you got the time? What does that mean? What is community? Going to that supermarket?
Mm-hmm. Basically.
Saying hi to the guy.
Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
It's where it begins and ends.
But when you started, I mean, where did you grow up?
Newcastle, northeast of England.
Is that a pretty place?
It's a beautiful place. It's one of those places that thrived in the Industrial Revolution. It's been through many, many incarnations, and it was Scotland, then England, then Scotland. It's a borderland, so the people are hearty and resilient and warm and loud and. But it's a very, very cold place.
Cold,
chilly, right there on the North Sea.
Yeah.
It's silvery, you know. It's like the fabric of the place is. It's all of its
gray?
Colors are gray and silver and purpley
that.
And
I love that.
It's magical in many, many ways.
But could
but
get
it
depressing.
Also, well, it has that. It almost has a feeling of Detroit.
Wow.
In the sense that it had this burgeoning industry during the Industrial Revolution. Then the nature has sort of reconsumed that. Industry,
so there's
old
a lot of
factories and buildings,
dead machines, dead factories.
Many, many things. It's been rejuvenated massively at the minute, which is wonderful. But also, I do feel sad that we're losing some of those incredible. I don't know. They're like
ghosts.
Testament. Yeah, there's strange
ghosts of the Industrial Revolution.
Strange, leafy car parks. You know, car parks with trees in the middle of them. We're losing a lot of those. And there's a lot of development going on right now there. And
your people there still?
Yeah, my mum and dad are there, and my sister's in London, and my sister is a brilliant. She does improvisation and comedy, and she's a brilliant writer.
Oh yeah,
yeah, and she's just funny as fuck.
Oh, that's great.
She's the only person who's actually made me spit out water at a table before.
Older, or younger?
She's younger.
Yeah.
She's younger. Yeah.
Just the two of you?
Yes. Yeah. And we've got quite a small family. My mum and dad are both only children.
Oh, really?
It's quite unusual.
How does that manifest itself emotionally? What do you notice about that?
I think a lot of separate worlds between the four of us, you know. I just remember growing up having a lot of sort of fertile private time in my mind.
Oh, yeah. Oh, like an only child.
A lot of, strangely, perhaps, yes.
Huh. Because I talked to somebody who was like, whose parents were both, I don't know if they were adopted or they were foster, or they didn't have parents, orphans.
You're reaching for that word.
Yeah. Took me a while. The parents were both orphans. So like, how do you come in? And he's a famous comedian. Mm. So how do you come into knowing how to engage with a child? You know?
I read something that an actor who I'd known and not worked with, but known in the British theatre, a very, very brilliant actor who passed away now, sadly. Both of his parents were deaf.
Right.
And he talked about growing up in sort of in total silence, really. And that's not how I grew. Actually, the soundtrack to my growing up was probably Hollywood. You know, my dad is a huge... old Hollywood enthusiast and used to, and his mom sold tickets at the theater after the Second World War, and so he used to go.
Oh, really?
From school to there and watch all the
like in the 30s and 40s and that kind of stuff.
It would have been 1950 probably when he was doing that. 1950 to about 1955.
How are you with the very old movies? I find that as I get older, I can handle them better. I watched one last night, an old John Garfield movie.
I love them. My dad and I, our tastes do cross, although, I'd say he's sort of more old Hollywood, more mainstream old Hollywood. You know, such an aficionado and knows every last name
from the old from the 40s and 50s.
He's a car dealer. He's, you know, he's that's his profession.
But, he sells cars.
Yeah, but just a
love movies.
Loves being in the cinema and loves that experience. And I perhaps lean more toward European cinema.
Oh, really?
And
yeah. I wish I knew more about. I wish I was more learned in European cinema.
Well, yeah, I think if you, I think if you find it for yourself, there's a huge, great difference, isn't there, between it, you know, having one of those incredibly culturally affluent upbringings where you sort of handed all of the best things first and, and made very aware that those are the best things and you should be should be working towards those.
Yeah.
Whereas if you find them for yourself sort of haphazardly and accidentally with lots of bumps along the way, I'm glad that I did that because it feels like a very personal discovery.
Yeah, and it's your and you have your own kind of you can put together your own point of view around all this stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a blueprint, really. It's a formative blueprint for you know, your own development.
And you've made choices and you know, either your dad sort of turned you on to some stuff and you were able, as time went on, to push back a little because you found your own things.
Absolutely.
And then you find people in your life that, as you move through life, that you respect and they tell you about a thing and you're like, oh.
Yeah.
And then you can sort of associate that thing with that person and that, you know, shift in your thinking because somebody inspired you to be
absolutely there. Absolutely, like, you know, thanks Dad for Humphrey Bogart and thanks like Sixth Form College for Tarkovsky, you know. What I mean, I'll take it.
Yeah. So like, do you remember which of those foreign movies were the first one to sort of make you go like, what the fuck is happening in the world?
I think the whole world of you know, not just European cinema really. Yeah. But I mean, I think anything that wasn't an English language film, and that was because perhaps there are so many, when you speak more than so, you know, to have English as your first language is such an extraordinary blessing and massive curse because it cuts you off from being able to understand many things, you know, including things like different types of code switching culturally and, you know, all the different... A language is so much more than just words, isn't it? It's, you know, it's the sort of philosophically and it's a mindset.
Mm.
And so perhaps that was the thing
That
I found most fascinating about the, so many doors were opened.
I get it. That you realize in a moment how limited you are.
Mm. You see your own limits.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that there's so many more worlds outside of your perception that is limited by your language of whatever it is. Like, it can go all the way to spirituality, everything.
Mm.
Cultural, spiritual, psychological. Mm. It's all tied into something myopic. And once you realize that, you're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Big world out there.
And I mean, I can't even imagine having a relationship with film or theatre where I was only interested in seeing things in my own language.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine that now. Because
do you speak other languages?
I mean, dreadfully, you know, really dreadfully.
Can you understand other languages?
Yeah.
That's good.
I can, yeah.
What, like French and Italian?
Well, a bit niche. My best mate speaks Cantonese and we used to work in a Chinese restaurant together, so... So I do understand Cantonese, especially when it's shouted at me, you know, quite loudly. And and French, you know, I understand. I have that awful British thing with speaking French, which is that my other half speaks French. He's beautiful, so eloquently speaks French as his first language, and I just feel like a total idiot, really. You know,
so you don't
pass
even
la ponte, you know, with my awful. I can't apply any of the tools that I have in my profession, you know,
to actually.
Yeah, no, because I'm a dreadful liar. I'm just the worst liar.
Yeah,
yeah, just crap at lying.
Really?
Which is perhaps maybe my only strength in acting.
That's weird because usually, you know, I think a lot of actors think that's their strength in acting is lying.
Not mine. I start sweating. But I think my imagination's very strong. So the belief that perhaps I'm somebody else is not too far of a stretch.
Right.
But to actually lie about something day to day, you know,
that's good. But keeps your soul clean if you can't lie.
It does. I've just been sent to I've just worked with some wonderful French directors with Catherine Deneuve, which was amazing, which is why I have no hair. Because my character was going through chemotherapy.
Oh, I was wondering what kind of choice it was.
It was a character. Yeah. Something to do with the character. And
you're working with Deneuve, did you say?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh. We finished a couple of months ago.
What was the relationship in the film?
She plays my mom.
Oh, wow.
And my character has moved. My character's American, but her mother is French, and they're estranged, and my character feels largely set aside by her mother in many different ways.
This sounds like a real uplifting movie.
Well, it actually is really funny.
Oh, good.
Because it's Catherine Deneuve, Morgan Saylor, and I, and about 200 chickens.
Chickens.
And strangely, Martin Scorsese's producing it. So it's a real odd combination of things.
So was it always understood that you were an actress? Was your sister? Were you both doing that kind of stuff since you both seemed to end up there?
I had the great fortune of growing up in a place that had the first free youth theatre in Britain, which was established in the 60s. It was called the People's Theatre, and it was a wonderful, wonderful theatre. And they used to do lots and lots of classical theatre and Mamet, and just it was somewhere to...
Kids doing Mamet?
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. We butchered it.
I think I'd love to see like a 14-year-old's version of Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yeah.
No, or American Buffalo.
Yeah, we butchered a lot of stuff. Pinter. Yeah. No stone was unturned.
That's great.
But I started there when I was about... I did the first play I did there was... I was 9 years old and...
Was it Pinter's birthday party?
I was playing, you know, Ralph Fiennes. Uh-huh. I was playing his great, 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 and a couple times more grandma. She was the first, the play was about her. Huh. He has this, as you can imagine, incredibly prolific family. The Fiennes are vast and sprawling in terms of all the incredible things they've done historically. In
is
great
that true?
Britain. It is. And, for example, Sir Ranulph Fiennes was an explorer.
Oh, I see. So it had nothing to do with Rafe. It was just that it was part of his family.
It was part of this long Fiennes lineage.
Yeah.
And Cecilia Fiennes was the first woman famously to ride England's side saddle.
Okay.
and there was a play, rather lovely play, in which I played little Cecilia.
Oh, interesting. He's a good actor.
Yes. Brilliant.
I just watched him in something, that thing with Chastain, where they go out to the desert.
Oh, yes. I'm looking forward to seeing that.
I just watched it. Mm. I'm not sure why I watched it. I watched it on the plane.
Mm.
He's very good in
He's extraordinary.
And she's really good.
She's wonderful.
Yeah.
She's wonderful.
So that's where you start?
And that's their second thing together, because they did Coriolanus.
I don't know if I saw that.
Rafe directed it and was in it.
Have you worked with him?
No. A couple of times we have almost worked together and it hasn't worked out. That's a crap story, isn't it? A couple of times.
Yeah, it's going to happen. We're leading up to it.
It's just not been right. It's
Yeah, but it seems like you'll work with everybody eventually.
I feel sorry for everybody now.
No. So at nine, is that when you are smitten or get the bug to do it? Do you know it's your life from that experience?
I think being in a dark room surrounded by lots of adults talking about literature and is intoxicating in a way that in a way that most kids really aren't afforded that experience as a kid.
Yeah,
and to be strangely treated like an adult, or to have the same expectations that you would have an adult. Of course, people treated me like a child as well. But there was a sense of having to. You had a job,
right?
you know, that you were.
And you had to act like an adult.
In many ways.
As best you could.
Yes, yes, in many ways.
I imagine, like, when you're starting out as a kid, you're playing roles that were supposed to be grown up, and you can't really think, like, I can't do this, I'm a kid.
Absolutely.
So you just do it.
Which in a sense, is what we're doing now, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're still doing that.
We are still doing that, but a lot of times it goes the other way. A lot of times they're casting people that are 90 to play 50. And you're like, you couldn't find anybody else? Is that name that big still that's going to draw people in?
I had a really odd career in that way because I started off playing, I played Margaret Thatcher, was one of the first things that I did in the UK.
TV?
On. Yes, and it was a sort of a film that was on television, and, yeah. and she goes from about, I don't know, 26 to 40.
Yeah.
Six or whatever, and I was 24 or 23 at the time. But then at the same time was also playing like 13-year-old in something else.
Right. So you had that, you were a blank slate.
Well, just, it's wonderful. It's wonderful to be able to connect with those different times in your life, ones that haven't even perhaps, you haven't experienced yet, you know, to imagine. Right. It's funny looking back. I'm not sure whether I would have done it actually any differently.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can only emotional. Well, I think there's some part of us that doesn't change that much emotionally. You'd like to think so. But I think the core thing, you know, the core emotional wiring you have, I mean, you can shut it off and turn it on and stuff. But I mean, to do a part when you're very young of a very old person, I mean, you can speculate and turn some things off and honor a script, but like when you actually get older, you're sort of like, I don't feel any different.
Is there any incarnation of yourself that you look back and almost can't recognize?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I don't know who the guy, I talk about it sometimes, about the guy who was, when I started doing comedy, who was running around doing one-nighters all over New England for, you know, in situations that were clearly terrifying and weird, and knowing the kind of person I was. I don't know who that guy was who got me through that shit.
Mm-hmm.
I would, like, the thought of doing any of them again, it's like, I can't even handle it.
I know.
Walking into situations where you're like, how am I even going to make this work?
I know. I think about that when I first left RADA, which was the drama school that I went to, and there were all these, thank God, different offers and things coming
in. The Royal
I
said Academy no of to, Dramatic Arts.
That's it, yeah. I said no to so many things, and I had such a clearly high opinion of myself. That I shouldn't have had, but I had such a so clearly knew what I did and didn't want to do, and I in a sense don't know whether I would have had that courage had I had those opportunities later on.
Huh? what were those? Like, what did you know?
Just very mainstream things that I wasn't really very interested in that were badly written and.
So when you got out of RADA, badly written and quite popular, RADA. So when do you start going to that school? Is that like a 4-year thing?
It's a 3-year thing, although they do all sorts of different things now. But it originally was a 3-year thing.
But that's like your college?
Yes, yes. And you get a
So you're doing all this sort of people's theater stuff.
Yes.
And you know, are you being taught at that time when you're in younger at all, or are you just doing plays?
No. In school all the time, you know, school like everybody else, and then after school going to the theater and then, you know, either rehearsing or being in a production.
But not being in an acting class.
No acting classes. The class really being doing it.
Right. So when did you have to audition for the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts?
Yes. Yes, I did. Yeah.
So you're pretty, you knew what you were doing.
Do you know what? I don't think I quite realized what I was doing until I looked at my application and I saw I'd been in 60 plays by the time I was 19. And I thought, oh, maybe I do actually, maybe I have some sense of what I'm doing here, or at least I certainly seem to be enjoying this.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You know, but a lot did go by the wayside. It's such a...
What, there?
As you know, it's such a, you have to be so devoted.
But when you auditioned, you probably had a level of experience and some fearlessness, at least to feel confident.
Yes, and I suppose what I'm referring to by things going by the wayside is really everything else. You know, I was academic, but I really had time only for for plays and you know, and
but the weird thing about
it was all consuming, I guess.
But the weird thing about plays, like you said earlier, the feeling of being around adults who are intellectual and having intellectual conversations is that, you know, plays in and of themselves, many of them are intellectual conversations.
In every way. I mean, so satisfying. You know,
So like, you know, you're getting it all.
Unbelievably transcendent as well. You know, I mean, it just the magic of being in a different time, speaking the words of a different time, even.
Yeah, for sure.
That kind of.
That's got to be the 80% of the thrill of doing Shakespeare.
It's incredible.
Time travel.
Have you ever read?
Probably not.
You may or may not like this, but it's Peter Hall, who's a director I worked with when I was younger.
Yeah.
Very, very brilliant director. He wrote a book called Shakespeare's Advice to Players, which basically picks out in all of Shakespeare's plays the small hints that he's giving his actors, because he was constantly noting them. He hated the, you know, he'd take issue with the way that people spoke as words.
Really?
Pentameter, okay. As an example. Yeah. You know, it's got the five beats, etc.
I'm weird. I have an aversion to Shakespeare, and I've had people...
Understandable.
...sell me it, but I still haven't embarked on reading it.
Mm. Well, when you read his instruction, the bard himself.
Oh, okay.
Well, when you read when Hall directs you to the bard's instructions about how to actually speak his text, he's basically just saying, "Say it."
Yeah.
And I think anything other than that seems inauthentic, and that's where we all run into problems. When you start trying to explain Shakespeare, you find yourself in a bit of a rut.
Yeah.
Or emphasize bits that don't need to be emphasized.
Do you love doing it?
Absolutely. I haven't done it for probably the longest. It's probably the longest stretch that I haven't done it for ever in my life is this last stretch.
I just watched The Dresser. Oh. When was the last time you saw that movie?
My goodness.
Oh, my God. I just, like, for some reason, I kept...
Quite a while.
Couldn't get that. I just had that thing in my head where, you know, Tom Courtney comes back into the dressing room and Albert Finney had put on Othello blackface. And he just turns around and he's like, "Wrong play! We're not doing that!" And just,
horrible.
But the acting in it is, Albert Finney's beyond like anything I've ever seen before. I don't know if you remember it. He's a guy who's in the middle of having an emotional and mental breakdown, you know, in, you know, war-torn England, running around with this Shakespeare company that's barely keeping it together. And he's the main actor and the leader of it. And he's losing his mind.
He's one of those performers, Albert Finney, who sometimes... only really truly brilliant performers can give an absolutely dreadful performance because they're so committed to sort of what they're doing.
Yeah.
And that sounds an awful way to describe any of Albert Finney's work because he's, you know, everything is genius. I'm just thinking about the one performance where I thought, how did that happen of Albert Finney's, which is, when he played Poirot. I mean, firstly, I'm not entirely sure where his Poirot's from. He's Italian in some parts and then... French and others, Belgian, Flemish.
Which play?
It goes all over the map.
What is it?
It's in the film. The film he plays. Murder on the Orient Express.
Oh, Perrault. Yeah.
And everybody's in it.
Yes,
at the time.
Yes, I remember.
Everyone and his mother is
terrible.
In the cast. He was extraordinarily, brilliantly bad. And only somebody as good as him could have been
so bad,
he was so utterly committed to those 22 different accents.
Yeah.
But everything that comes out of his mouth comes from his toes, so you kind of don't care.
Well, that's one of those movies that should have been in and of itself kind of over the top. You know, it's sort of like Knives Out.
Well, interestingly, Agatha Christie said that Albert Finney was her favorite Poirot.
Oh yeah,
she was in it and watched it in the theater.
Huh? Maybe
I think that was a Spidey senses where she was picking up on his sort of just golden quality of acting.
Uh huh. Yeah, I think it's an over-the-top genre, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
All right, so you get into the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. So what do you learn after being your own?
I mean, to be honest, Mark, everything and all at once, it seemed like.
Yeah.
You know, it was...
You were ready, though.
I mean, just, I was so ready.
Yeah.
I had stopped doing it for a while before I went to RADA.
What'd you do?
I didn't think... Just had lots of different jobs, worked in a Chinese restaurant, as I said.
Learned some Cantonese.
Yeah, yeah.
But you knew you wanted to be an actor.
No. I didn't know whether that's what I was going to do.
So you're kind of bumming around, having a crisis, working at a Chinese place.
I wouldn't say bumming around. It wasn't an easy time, but it was a... But I'm glad I had it.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time I got to RADA, I really felt, I already had my own place. I'd had lots of jobs. I was self-sufficient. I sort of...
Yeah.
I was just ready to work and
to learn.
Have
you been heartbroken?
In my life.
Yeah. At that time, did you go through a full arc of youth and you were sort of felt grounded in a certain amount of humility and acceptance?
No, not right. I mean, yes, of course I'd been heartbroken. Mm. But, that was like the least of my problems, really, to be honest.
Well, that's good.
I mean, it was fucking horrible, don't get me wrong, but it was, when you're a teenager, I feel like being heartbroken is something that you can kind of almost, at least your depression has purpose.
Right, yeah. It's a rite of passage.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No. But when I got there, it was interesting to see. We had many different people from many different walks of life in my year at college, and it was interesting to see how everyone who was where everybody was. Some people hadn't made toast for themselves before,
right?
And it was their time to. It was their hedonistic. It was their time to let rip and find themselves.
But
and,
there were some people they kind of admit all ages kind of deal. It's based on talent. So you had people there that were may have been older as well and been through some. How does it work?
Based on talent, they're very, unfortunately, have lots of donations. So they're able to really choose who they want to choose.
Yeah.
And between about 18 and 30 is the... And they take on 30 people a year.
Pretty exclusive.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think I would get in, to be honest. I coughed a skin ball up in my second audition in the middle of a speech. Haven't done it before or since.
What?
Exactly. What I don't know. It was like a tiny ball of skin came from my throat.
What?
Yeah, in the middle of a speech.
What does that even mean?
I was doing... I mean, I assume it was skin, unless it was like a nut or something. Oh, yeah. I hadn't been eating nuts. I was doing... Cymbeline. I was doing a speech from Cymbeline, and halfway through, I sort of, in Disney's Aladdin, where the camel spits out a hairball.
It was
a bit like that, but smaller.
Yeah.
And that came out.
You thought that was going to
obviously said sorry. said sorry and carried on, and then toward the end had a conversation about thinking, perhaps musing on whether Shakespeare was a woman, which didn't go down very well. And then, I didn't think I was going to hear anything back after that one. I thought, well, I got to the second round, but fuck it.
But they can see past that.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah. So you get in there and like, how does one hit the ground running at that place?
It was so wonderful. I mean, I think everybody who goes, it's a rite of passage, isn't it?
Yeah.
Any kind of education.
Yeah, sure.
Institution or whatever. But it was so practical and hands-on, and there was nothing theoretical about it. And it was like having a really, really intense 6 jobs at once.
Mm.
So you just practiced and practiced and practiced and practiced.
Speech, movement, dance, Shakespeare.
And being in a wheel of different productions all the time. So constantly being able to... hone your craft, in lots of different ways, and then being given tools by people who are working in the industry as dialect coaches or voice coaches, all sorts.
So you really got
things,
the full picture.
Methods, teachers, and that was just, it was invaluable. I don't think it's for everyone. I think for me, I wouldn't have. I can't imagine those 3. I had a fantastic year, and I can't imagine that. Those 3 years being spent with any other group of humans than the ones that I spent them with. It was wonderful.
Did you ever try doing, comedy or improv or any of that stuff?
Yeah. I did a lot of comedy.
Before?
Pretty early on, actually. Funnily enough. Well, my first foray into film, Mike Lee was my first experience with film, but my first sort of larger role in a film was more comedic.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, I was also at the RSC at the same time. So it was, that was kind of as I was having this quite surreal experience of.
So you went from RADA to the RSC?
I went from RADA to the National and then from the National to the RSC. And the National's the sort of wonderful theater in
London. Yeah, I've been there. I saw Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf there.
Did you?
At some point, yeah.
Who was it? Can you remember who it was?
It was many years ago.
Many moons ago. I just saw Zach Quinto in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Did you see that production
no,
over here?
No, uh-uh.
He was absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
Because for the first time, it was the first time I'd heard the words again. Because Richard Burton's performance is so vast and incomparable. And, you know, I heard so many things that I hadn't heard before.
Huh.
It was really wonderful.
I think that's the amazing thing about a great piece of art in general is that it kind of grows with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a matter of, you know, your perception or interpretation, and it kind of grows with you. It's great.
It does.
Yeah, the theater thing is like, it's got to be the best. You know, I didn't spend my life trying to be an actor. And when I do it, especially in films or in TV, I don't necessarily find it as satisfying as I'd like because of the waiting. But I know what it's like to perform. Mm. And I imagine, like, you know, locking into a play, it's got to be the best.
It really is. I mean,
because you're in it, man. You just.
Perhaps the harrowing thing is the repetition for 6 months,
sure.
You know, depending on what's happening in the play.
I guess that's a different kind of repetition. Like, it's one thing to be in a trailer for 10 hours and do a scene, you know, 50 times, as opposed to, like, doing a show every night for 50, 60 days.
And even just in a really reductive way, I mean, say, like, 10, 20 years ago, and it's still happening now, where, you know, doing a lot of classical theater and playing a male or a female role is a completely different experience, you know.
Yeah.
I remember an actor saying to me years ago, "Oh God, I just love doing a play. It's fantastic. Get in there,
yeah.
First act, break, second act, courtroom scene, straight down the pub." And me thinking, "Wow, that's really not the. I've just lost my husband, had my hand chopped off, been, you know, often the woman's role in theatre is to emote.
Right.
And to do that over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Sometimes is taxing. And that's changing, of course. Everything's changing.
Yeah.
Hugely. Yeah. And we're also, which I think is fucking brilliant, everybody's playing every type of role now.
Yeah.
Which has just been such a long time coming because we're all humans, aren't we?
Sure.
To speak to Shakespeare, all the parts were played by the same demographic, right?
Yeah.
So why shouldn't we all be able to play everything? I mean, in some way.
Sure.
But
so when you're at the Royal Shakespeare Company, how many Shakespeare plays do you do?
Now I'm just backtracking on my words there. I'm saying we should all be able to play everything.
Okay.
I don't really believe that. What I meant was, in classical theatre,
yeah,
and in theatre,
yeah,
we none of us are Elizabethan humans.
Yeah.
So why not give everyone a chance to...
Sure.
If we want to keep that kind of theatre alive, that kind of verse alive, why not give everyone a chance to be able to explore it? That's what I mean.
Yeah.
I don't think we should all be able to play everything, actually.
Yeah, it seems to be going a different direction.
Well, right? Yeah, it's not... That's actually not... I don't think that's helpful at all, actually.
Right.
You know.
But I think the idea that I'm getting is that there are roles that were designated. And in it seems in some classical theater that, you know, men were playing women and women, that there was some, that the humanity of the play should be available to any human.
That's exactly it. And beautifully put.
Good. But how many do you do when you're there, like Shakespeare plays, when you're at the company?
It depends. I was doing a shorter run because I was there with the Peter Hall Company, and we were doing a little bit of it with the RSC, a little bit of it was at the Theatre Royal in Bath. Sometimes he does plays in town, you know, in London, but often you do them in rep. So at the National or at the RSC, you'll do three plays in rep. And it's a wonderful experience. It's an experience where you feel like, you know, a band of players. It's something familiar.
Community.
If you come out of drama school, it's community.
We talked about that earlier. That you know, the idea of community is very real in theater.
Well, I think it's hard for performers often to be cut off from their lifeblood. You know, like for you or I, we're used to an audience or it's a special rapport.
Mm.
It feeds you in some way, whether you're aware of it or not, and it's something that's it's a spiritual thing. I mean, as much as anything else. And when that's cut off, it's the thing about being a stand-up or an actor. You can't just stand on the street corner and try and make people laugh or do a monologue.
You can.
Nobody wants to listen. I mean, you can.
It's called busking.
People do. But it's difficult.
Sure.
You know.
There are
certain circumstances that it's a bit difficult. It's a bit different than picking up a guitar.
Yeah, for sure.
Mainly because you're just fucking irritating if you're standing doing that.
Yeah,
half the time.
Trying to get people. Hey, come on over. Look at, I'm doing a thing.
But I think one of the difficult things when you leave an institution like that or a company like that, or you stop doing the shows or you get off the road, is that you lose that connection.
Yeah, I make sure I try to keep hold of it.
Yeah, try to keep it.
Like, that's why I go do these shorter sets and stuff, just to make sure that part of me, the muscle that is in constant connection with an audience, is still active.
I remember when we were doing Birdman, Zach would go and do evening. He would go and do stand-up after a day of shooting.
Galifianakis?
Yeah.
Where were you shooting that?
New York.
Because he doesn't do it that much anymore. But sometimes he comes around because I think he has a very profound love-hate relationship with expectations of a stand-up stage.
Right.
But it's funny, though. He does, you know, when he does crave it and he does show up, it's kind of effortless for him.
He's an incredible, I just found him to be an incredible person working with him.
Well, that's what, like, you've done a lot of interesting movies. So whatever your choices were after you got out of, when you were sort of, when the world decided you were worthy of being elevated, we're going to deliver this woman into the great realm of show business.
Right, yeah. Jazz hands out.
But you were, like, you protected yourself.
I hope so, yeah.
Well, I mean, like, you know, you said that your first experience was with Mike Lee. That must have been life-changing.
Well, yeah, and you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, do you? You know, the things that I learned from that experience, that it's important to preserve those things. And I'm sure you have the same thing.
A few.
With material, with thoughts, with meaningful things.
Yeah, people you've worked with and, you know, people that have inspired you.
Yeah.
People, you know, and I've met a lot of people now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I do take away some things. But, I mean, what did you take away from with him? Because that was so early on.
So many things.
Yeah.
So many things. In many ways, to stop being such stop doing as much work.
Yeah.
I'm not work shy.
Yeah.
And sometimes that just becomes counterproductive and, you know, more of an obsession.
Overworking, you mean? Yeah, sure. I could see that.
That's something that's valuable. But that and just a freedom.
Mm.
I think filmmakers like Mike have retained the sort of integrities, it's the stuff of dreams for most of us, really. Mm. And it takes a very, very strong character to be able to
for a whole
retain
career.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to be very clear about what you do and don't want to put your energy into.
Well, that's a hell of a lesson to learn if you can hold on to that and make that your life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I often feel so, I'm quite susceptible to just being dragged in lots of different directions. Are you?
No,
great.
I mean, I have, but it's taken a certain amount of fortitude and I think just basic success to be able to say no as much as possible and make sure I'm not doing it out of fear.
Right. I think my problem might be if my heart gets involved or, then I'm all in, regardless of whether it's like good for me or not, or, you know,
yeah.
should be, maybe not all in. So, no, I've spent a lot of time sort of playing the lead in independent film.
Right.
What's, I think, sometimes what's distressing is that, you know, those anti-heroes, those female anti-heroes, or those anti-heroes who just aren't white dudes,
right,
white guys, often aren't the, you know, only now are we seeing more protagonists,
right,
that fit that bill.
Right.
It's
in mainstream movies, you mean.
And I have conversations like this all the time as a producer.
Yeah.
But it's the sort of goodness and redemption and purity that's demanded of a female character that's not demanded of a male character.
Right.
You know, to center a film around that, you know, in Shadow Dancer, I play a member of the IRA who ultimately is responsible for the deaths of many people, you know, and she's also a young mother.
Mm.
And so for a lot of people, that's, you know, it's a difficult thing to wrap your head around.
Yeah.
That said, I met many of those women who were in exactly that situation.
Yeah.
And so really it's just a reflection of life. And I think so rarely in cinema do we reflect life.
Yeah.
I mean,
certainly not in mainstream movies.
And the morality that the characters are held to, or the sort of the moral standards that they're held to,
yeah,
is so unreal.
Right.
So
has that been your quest as a producer to bring more of that?
In every way.
Yeah.
I mean, I think when you read something and you think, oh, that's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Whether that's Rosalind in As You Like It, who is posing as a man, or it's a completely, you know, a writer-director who's just emerging and has not really had the right platform or,
yeah,
spotlight or support.
Yeah.
And they've created an LGBTQ plus musical written in beat poetry, which is what Please Baby Please is, a film that we made recently. I made that with a brilliant writer-director called Amanda Kramer. Those things, I think for anyone, if they get to you, they make your soul sing, because it's something, when you share those pieces with people and when people see them, I rarely have I ever heard the feedback when people finally do see these things of, you know, well, that wasn't fucking worth it. You know,
right,
it's always, the feedback is always, how extraordinary, and why is there not more of this?
Yeah, because, like, you know, our perception is dictated by what is the most sort of hammered into us all the time. So when we see these smaller stories, you know, about people that live different lives or difficult lives, or maybe, you know, are not happy ending movies, we've been sort of programmed to believe that those are somehow, like, require a different type of attention,
mm-hmm,
or are, you know, not, you know, they're going to be too heavy, or what, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah, and just the narrow representation of every demographic, or,
yeah,
the misrepresentation of every demographic. The more voices that we get, the more varied voices we get, I think in cinema, the better.
It's true with everything.
With everything.
Yeah, I mean, how, you know, would you rather have a bunch of white guys making up points of view,
mm-hmm,
or just get the points of view from the source?
But we also have an extra responsibility in our industry as filmmakers, I think, because it is such a privileged industry, because there is so much money flying,
yeah,
about.
Yeah.
And, you know, the majority of the world's struggling at the same time.
Sure.
And whatever we put out there, even if you think about the film Gandhi, you know,
yeah,
but whatever we put out there sometimes even unfortunately becomes historical fact, you know, in the most dangerous, insidious way.
Yeah.
So, we have a responsibility in every way to not be just trying to fund people's second homes in Palm Springs.
Yeah, to do the real art.
Yeah, and to care about the details.
Yeah.
To care, to ask. To,
yeah.
So, to put it in the right hands, to put,
sure,
it in the hands of somebody who has an experience of whatever the hell it is we're,
you know, what the story
talking
is
about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is that what you do with the production company?
Well, the production company is it was sort of born out of a bit of frustration, really, and me just really getting sick of the sound of my own voice moaning about, you know, the state of things. And you can only do that so long before you actually just pull your finger out your arse and do something about it. But just sees a project from its inception, you know, through its development, its the making, the shooting of it, and then sort of beyond distribution even. And it's a sort of financial cushion at all of those turns.
Yeah.
For a film that may, at any of those points that I just mentioned, get lost.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure we've both had that experience of being in something that you feel so proud of, and it's just fucking, you just think, yeah. God, I would love everyone to see this. And it's just a wall.
It's happening now with our movie.
It can only be scaled by money.
Yeah, it makes me not want to do things. Like, because I'm not, yes. No, I mean, just as an actor, because it's not really my bread and butter. And, I do get something out of it, and I get offered a lot of these small movies. But there's, it's not usually a lot of times I'm just sort of like, I'm not going to put my life into this unless, you know, it has, you know, what you're talking about, deeper meaning, or it feels good to me. But yeah. A lot of times it's just so discouraging. Because most things, I talk to directors all the time. It's like they'll put 5-6 years into something, and it's like, where can I see it? And they're like, I don't know if it's on right now, but you know, it's like, it's terrible. The heartbreak is fucking, I can't, like, just the fact that I haven't seen most of your independent movies makes me feel shitty, because like, I don't know about them. You know, I got to go look for them.
Yeah.
And like our movie right now, fucking distributor dropped the ball on, you know, facilitating something that would bring a lot more attention to the movie. And it's just sort of like one idiot's going to like that happened. And now this movie that's struggling with 100% Rotten Tomatoes scores that everyone should see because of the work you did, the work we all did, is now, you know, it's been hobbled by the people that are responsible for putting it out there.
I think, I think the more transparent we are about it, the better.
Yes.
And the what people don't quite understand is that there is not an equal, there's not equal footing for everyone. And that's not because of huge $100 million publicity budgets. That's because there literally isn't equal footing.
Yeah.
And we're operating in a system where everything costs something, even to just submit your film to an awards platform.
Yeah.
And if people aren't aware of that, there are, as there always have been, a few players that have a lot of power, and those always change. They revolve and change. But I think one of the most sad things is, and also like is dangerous things, is this assumption that we know what an audience wants.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the most.
And who are those people that decide that? What are the numbers? What's the mathematics? Mostly it's just people that are afraid of losing their jobs.
It's that constant conversation in our industry. You want to see something new, so you bring something new and they say, we haven't seen it before.
Yeah.
Who's this going to be? Where's the audience?
Who's attached? Yeah.
And it's actually, I think, a huge judgment on not just cinema goers, but consumers, you know, at large. I hear so many times people saying there's nothing to watch. When there's so much, as we know, so much stuff being made all the time.
Well, but that's because only these certain things get through, and I think people get overwhelmed and exhausted by the choices. So you have to, someone has to guide them somewhere.
They do, but it's the height of. I mean, it's evil. I mean, there are kids starving. The amount of things that are being made, and I think a lot of the time, unfortunately, things end up being background noise, you know, and then there's maybe 10-20% that gets through that's like really fantastic quality, and that's wonderful. And one of the things that I absolutely love is that some of the great filmmakers like Iñárritu and I mean, there's so many like him now are being championed by those bigger platforms and being allowed to do what they want to do.
Honoring their vision.
So, I mean, I don't know if you've seen Bardo, but
I have it. I got to watch it.
Oh, I'm really interested. I'm really, really interested to hear what you have to say about that, actually.
Yeah. You loved it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I generally like his movies.
he's one of, I mean, just one of the best people I've ever worked with.
Why?
So brave, so brave, so courageous, you know, has his strength of vision. Mm. And also he's a musician, really, in his blood.
Yeah.
So there's always this beat that I feel with Alejandro, you know, when you watch his films, when you're around him, when you, there's something intoxicating about his sort of zest for exploring life and psychology and his fearlessness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm excited to watch it.
Yeah.
But it was it was definitely exciting and an honor to work with you as an actor.
Oh, and are you?
Well, I mean, I did. Yeah, think I could.
My God. My God.
My friend went to see it. My friend Steve, who's a director.
Yeah.
And he was like, wow, she was amazing. And she's like, the whole thing. And he said, before you came on, right out of the gate, she was just doing this thing. And he was, and this is a guy I know since college. He goes, I was worried about you. Like, Because he hadn't come on yet. And I'm like, is Mark going to be able to hold up? And he said, you did good. He said, it must have been like being in the ring with Tyson. But I didn't feel that at all. I felt we did, you know, it was all pretty, I wasn't nervous or afraid of it. And, you know, I just, you know, felt like we showed up pretty well.
I couldn't have wished for a better partner. Honestly, I couldn't have. And I felt so... In all of the ways that Leslie feels seen, loved, accepted, and judged in an appropriate way by Sweeney, I felt those things straight away.
Yeah,
it was natural. It was just very natural. Yeah. I can't imagine it any other way.
Well, thank you.
And I'm so happy. I'm so happy that this is the way that it worked out.
Yeah, and I hope more people see the movie. It was great talking to you.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you for making the
time. It's lovely talking to you.
You feel all right?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, I feel all right. I always feel like an idiot, but, you know, generally apart from... I think that's probably a good sense to always keep, you know, in your back pocket.
Keep that fresh.
Just remember you're an idiot. Like,
yeah, and everything is very fleeting.
Mm.
Nothing's that relevant.
Nothing's that relevant.
Good talk to you. Okay, that was me and Andrea Riseborough. Right? Right? She's pretty amazing. Right? The movie To Leslie is available to buy or rent on most video on demand platforms or watch your screeners, Academy members. All right, hang out for a second. Okay, listen up. We've got something in the works for Full Marin subscribers. By the time you're hearing this, I'll have gone to my first wrestling show. So we've got bonus material coming up with my trip to AEW at the Forum. I also had the AEW owner Tony Khan and wrestler Chris Jericho over to the garage.
You're paying some dues. Did you ever, did you do those gigs that like comics do, like hell gigs?
All of them. I did a kid's birthday party once for a hot dog and an orange juice.
Really?
That's my best payoff, yeah. But yeah, you do all those ones. I mean, I remember in Mexico, some of the places we worked were so shitty. I remember a guy taking a shower out of the back of a toilet.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, it's okay, it's clean water. I'm like, dude, it's from a toilet. Like, yeah. I don't care how clean it is. But a toilet is a toilet.
So, but they always had a ring?
They always had a ring. Sometimes there are boxing rings, which are hard like this table.
Right.
You're not doing any... We call them bumps, and not bumps of cocaine. Bumps are the falls that you take in wrestling.
Yeah.
You're not taking a lot of bumps in a boxing ring because it's just too hard. So you would just go out there and just pantomime and just fuck around because it's not on TV and there's 50 drunks in the crowd. And just get the hell out of there and get your 200 pesos and go home.
Was there like ever nights where there was like 10 people? And
oh, eight? Yeah. The smallest crowd I think I wrestled was in Rimby, Alberta, 7 people.
Yeah.
And it's hard. Listen, I could wrestle in the stadium tomorrow in front of 70,000 people and be less nervous than wrestling in front of 7 people.
Yeah, it's you got to hold 7 people.
And you can see, as you know, you see each person in the crowd. You actually get to know these people. I'm sure you've done the same gigs. Like, oh, the guy with the dark hair is getting bored. I better like do something.
And you're then there's the war against embarrassment.
Yeah. Because when there's seven people there, it's already a little sad.
It's terrible. And the people that are there are embarrassed.
Yeah, everyone's embarrassed.
It's like we made the wrong decision to come to the wrestling tonight. Yeah. Oh my God. Same with the band. Sometimes you play, it's like, oh, fuck. Not anymore, thankfully. But we played the games with seven people with the band, too. That sucks also.
I never understood it. But you'd go do the show. But when I'd get there, I'd be like, you know, what? Do you want to go? Do you want to just leave? You can go.
Yeah. I feel bad for you. You're right. It's so embarrassing.
It's a little weird, but they always stay, dude.
They do. And then once again, that's the real secret. That's paying your dues. If you can get a crowd of seven interested in what you're doing,
yeah,
that's a hell of a talent to be able to have.
Well, they don't want to hurt your feelings. So they're going to say, if you walk a crowd of seven, even two of them, that's got to be worse.
Yes.
To sign up for the full marathon so you can get all the Wrestling with Mark bonus content, go to the link in the episode description and or click on WTF Plus over at WTFpod.com. Next week, I talked to director Todd Field on Monday about Tar in the Bedroom and how he invented Big League Chew. On Thursday, I talk with Oscar winner Octavia Spencer. All right, now I'm just like, I labor over this guitar, but this one was a little slack. But I played it. Monkey and La Fonda, Cat Angels everywhere.